Welcome. I'm glad you all made it out. If you haven't had a chance, look at the Flatirons after this. These snowy mornings are really beautiful in the way that they coat the mountains, so take a look at that. Today we have a really important topic to discuss, and I think that it'll be a fun conversation. Some things that I wanted to share, just a little bit of background. I am the student chair of the design committee here at the Conference on World Affairs. We work throughout the year to bring speakers from different backgrounds to the Boulder campus to share their knowledge and to speak on interdisciplinary panels. It's a really great thing. For our community members, it's an awesome opportunity to get involved. I'm an engineering and a design student here, and the way that design can offer opportunities for us to address global pressing challenges is a really huge passion of mine, and I think we have four speakers here today that believe the same. We're here to discuss the nature of pressing environmental and social challenges and the way that resilience can help us combat these challenges. Throughout, we're going to be accepting questions. Producers, if you could raise your hand. We're taking paper copies. They'll bring you a pen and a note card. You can write a question down and bring it up. We are also accepting questions through the app, and I'll have them right up here to be able to look at. We prioritize student questions, but I'll be taking all of them, and I'll do my best to aggregate those questions. And with that, I think we can jump into our first speaker. We have Ann Deigel visiting here from Louisiana, and she'll share about her perspective on resilient community planning.
Well, actually, I want to start with a definition. Resilience is the capacity to adapt to changing conditions and to maintain or regain functionality and vitality in the face of stress and disturbance. It's the capacity to bounce back after disturbance or interruption. And I think that individually, a lot of us are more resilient than others. But here, we're today to talk about, I think, what it means for the larger community. Obviously, our vulnerability is increasing from both internal and external disturbances. We have found that we are not doing so well. We're ill-prepared. Our institutions, our infrastructure, our traditional systems really need a realignment. Cities and states, and to some degree the federal government, we tend to react rather than proactively plan. And I'm a planner, foremost. We have to adapt to new paradigms. And the most important thing, I think, from an environmental, social, physical, and a financial standpoint is to rein in sprawl. It's been called the greatest American experimental failure in history. And maintaining it right now is bankrupting us. We're the only country, look at it this way, that did not invest in our cities post-World War II. Detroit, a few years ago, looked like Berlin after it had been bombed. And today, and that's today, today Berlin is a vibrant, amazing city. But they're the cradles of our civilization, and I think the number one thing we need to do is to reinvest in our city centers. The second thing we have to do that's going to be much more expensive is retrofitting the suburban sprawl that we have to make it more walkable, more accessible, diverse, and compact. And increasingly, that sprawl that we've developed, it's being abandoned. And some people are calling it the next, the new American ghetto. Social justice and equity have got to be a part of the conversation. But we really can't do that until we have the physical infrastructure and systems in place, till we address that. Because there are operating systems that are in place that promote sprawl, that actually require it legally. We have our mortgage and insurance systems, the way we have professional organizations, special interests. We have lobbying interests. The road building industry, for instance, very, very powerful in Washington. Our zoning codes are tantamount to legally enforced segregation, economic and social segregation. Suburban areas tend to have a lack of good, well-designed civic and shared space, which to me is the greatest detriment. because that's what determines our equity and quality of life. So we have to develop these things first before we can address, I think, some of the wider problems. And it requires a comprehensive approach, of course. And I will just say real quickly that I worked with the Princess Foundation in London, and the Prince of Wales has a program called Building Community. And they their mission is to transform lives by building resilient communities using design coding and community-based planning. And I think it's something that we should really look at here. But one of the things we developed is a matrix. It's a community capital matrix that deals simultaneously, because you have to do everything simultaneously, with the natural, the social, the built, and the financial networks, and based on key principles of desirability. And, of course, that is all determined locally through the community planning.
Great. Anne, thank you so much. One thing that I forgot to announce at the beginning of the panel is the panel number. This is panel 3104. And Anne, thank you so much. I think that provides a really great launching point for Sarah to join the conversation. Sarah Kaufman joins us from NYU, where she's a researcher on transportation and a variety of other tech-related topics. Yeah, to you, Sarah. Yeah,
thanks for having me. So I have been talking with quite a few of you over the last few days about transportation, but today the focus is more on the smart cities angle of climate change. So basically the role of technology when we talk about climate change is to detect problems and allow for rapid response, and then to mitigate the impacts of climate change. By that I mean we're seeing all sorts of climate-related impacts on our infrastructure. For example, Amtrak train tracks have melted in the last couple of summers, and so they've had to be replaced. The steel is actually melting in the heat, and not even only in the South, but in the Mid-Atlantic region. So not where you might imagine. We're also seeing a lot of flooding on our streets, which can be mitigated through of course, acting on our climate issues, but more immediately through design interventions. Things like permeable pavement and sensored networks that can detect flooding early to allow for rapid response for draining the area and clearing sewage outlets. Another impact of climate change that we're starting to see in many cities is disease outbreaks. The impacts of flooding and extreme temperatures leads to major health issues. And again, using data to track these outbreaks and to preempt any impacts of a flood, we can actually help mitigate the impacts, ideally. And finally, we can use our data through sensors, but through collaboration of data. Right now, a lot of cities detect flooding, peaks in energy usage through extreme heating and cooling. But if we collaborate among cities, regions, countries, and internationally, we can get a more holistic picture of what's happening. And in that way, we can learn from other countries, much as Ashley is going to teach us, and we can help to predict and respond more quickly. We can also do something called crowdsourcing. Are you familiar with the term crowdsourcing? Yeah, so that's the concept that you use information from the general public to help detect a trend or a pattern. That's being used, say, right now in Hawaii. They have residents detecting tsunamis and who can kind of ping an alarm, and so they rely on people who live at the water's edge to ring the alarm if something is coming. So that's another way of collecting data. Of course, we know that technology can be flawed. It can be buggy. If anyone here has used an automatic toilet that didn't flush right away, you get an idea of what it might look like if there is a kind of blink in the technology infrastructure. If it's a minor thing when the toilet doesn't flush right away, but when it doesn't detect a tsunami or a rising sea level, that's a bigger problem. And so we have to work to improve our technologies and also incorporate that data on a more generalized level. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much. Sorry about that. I had so many thoughts. I was trying to jot down on my own. So the perspective of tech is really valuable. We're going to transition a little bit. We're going to go to Ross first. I told Leslie that she, as a newbie, could join the conversation at the end. Anyway, Ross, as a compliment to the conversation on tech, Ross comes from an architecture background, and when we were talking in the green room, he introduced himself as a greenhouse and treehouse designer. I think treehouse was actually what you introduced yourself as. So maybe we can look at the relationship between the environment, discovery, and play, and maybe a child's perspective on the concept of resilience.
Well, that's interesting. He asked me how I got into architecture, and I said my first thing that came to mind is I love building treehouses, which is true. The angle that I look at with resilience is social resilience. And social resilience is personal resilience. If we're stressed, we have a really hard time coming back. And I've got to say, as I flew in and I look at the amazing sprawl around Denver, and I've been here before, and I've been around metropolitan cities all over the country, and the sprawl, as Anne's talking about, is a disaster. It's a rolling disaster it's a wonderful place. You've got kids, it brings people together. You've got dogs, you've got togetherness. Okay, so the kids go and leave home. And the dogs die. They don't live a long time. And so then you're alone, and you're alone on a very wide street flanked with garage doors and this grand portico entry and a living room that is a formal living room, and who's there? You're in your media room, your family room, your backyard with your barbecue, and that's your safe haven. And you come home, from a day at work, and it's really hectic, and you need just a retreat. Oh, so you drive home, and you're home, safe, to a degree. Except that isolation is growing. And not only in the suburbs, but in the cities. I've got an aunt and uncle who live in an apartment. They're now in their late 80s and mid-90s, and their friends have passed away. Younger friends have moved away. They don't have children. So we're checking in as much as we can. But in terms of day-to-day, the anxiety levels are getting really high, and that's affecting personal ability to respond. Loneliness, isolation, depression, high blood pressure, a lot of the illnesses that come on to us slowly. That's why I'm saying that the structure of our environments are weakening the fabric of our own personal resilience. If you're a child and you are stepping out into life and it's all stressful, you're a mom and you're trying to do what a village used to do. You remember it used to be, well, the long story of us, 200,000 years, people help me out, but I'm not an expert on this. Humans have been around for 200,000 years. This crazy thing that we've been doing since the automobile era is you couldn't even register the blink. And we think that independence and privacy are like the highest goals. The American dream has gone awry. And so we end up in our houses with everything that we need, and we ended up isolated among a sea of houses. And so for a child growing up, not only in the American suburb, and I don't know about cities, and let alone people who are really traumatized in other conditions, other states, you're traumatized. And so the trauma is baked in, is impressed in your body. And so you've got to be an adult, and you have continued to go with that trauma. And the trauma, it does not allow for resilience, personally. What I've been doing in the last 20 years or so is that I recognized that there is a need, one, for homes of other than family-sized homes. And so there's a need for small homes in a community setting. And I worked with helping change the zoning code in our town to give incentives to do infill in a community setting. And so we built these cottages around a landscape, around a garden. And then I realized the importance of what we had done later. And that's the scale of sociability. In small groups, conversation is spontaneous. It's what we do. We're hardwired for it. You isolate any of us, and it's not working pretty soon. And after a while, it's really not working. That's what's happening. And so what I'm trying to look at as we move out into establishing a base of resilience is taking a look at how the scale of sociability, being in some relationship with nearby neighbors, either intentionally or in some other setting, taking your backyard fences out and pulling your backyards, you know, together a bit, is going to provide a social resilience that is going to be really needed at different times of our lives, and both individually and collectively.
Great.
Thank you, Ross. Next, we'll move to Leslie Price. Leslie Price joins us from Denmark. She's the communications director for a firm called Index, which offers design awards for sustainable thinking and systems thinking. So at that, I'll let you join the conversation.
Great, thank you. It's really a pleasure to be here, and nice to see so many people here. So I guess I can just give you a little bit of background. As we mentioned, that we give out design awards. So basically, yeah, we do. Thank you very much.
Can you hear everybody?
Yeah, can everyone hear at the back there? Yeah,
okay.
Great. So yeah, we look at basically all kinds of design that is made to basically benefit humanity and solve global challenges, whether that's environmental, social, economic. I guess if you notice from the accent, I'm actually Australian. So I moved to Copenhagen about 7 years ago. And perhaps I'm a little biased here, but I think Copenhagen is probably an excellent example of what a resilient city is. If we look at Anne's definition, you know, thinking of functionality and vitality, I think there's a lot that we can learn from Copenhagen. I mean, some very specific examples is basically, you know, bringing farming into the city, vertical farming, hydroponics, carbon neutral buildings, and basically, yeah, green energy, of course. And then I think what's really important is how the city is developed, specifically making sure student and social housing is very well integrated into the city. I think that really plays a role in how a city prospers. I guess, yeah, continuing on from that, touching on what Ross was talking about, the social well-being. I think Copenhagen does a really good job at that. And that's basically, you know, if you build up these cities to make sure that people are happy, I mean, that really fosters resilience. And I think Copenhagen is very strong at doing that. And, really ensuring that quality of life. And just touching on what was said earlier about tech solutions, I think what's really important is that we also focus on some really simple solutions that don't, yeah, that are quite old-fashioned. I can give one incredible example. If any of you guys have heard of Alejandro Aravena, he's a Chilean architect. A couple of years ago, we gave an award to him, and he basically, there was a very large earthquake in Chile, and of course, subsequently, a very large tsunami, which destroyed a, you know, thousands and thousands of homes. A lot of people passed away. It was horrible. And basically, they came up with a solution to build a forest along the coastline. And it sounds like a very simple, probably not a very pragmatic solution. But in fact, if another tsunami of the same size were to hit the city, it would actually absorb almost 40% of the impact and the damage. So again, it's a very, very simple solution, very low tech. But it's incredible that you can sort of have these, what would seem like that it wouldn't work at all, but it's since been installed, and it's fingers crossed nothing happens like that. But I think it's really important to not only look at tech solutions, but at different ways we can ensure that we keep our cities safe, and of course that we keep people happy. So
great, perfect. Yeah, thank you, Leslie. With that, we have the opportunity to move into our question and answer session. We have gotten a few questions already. If you have more, again, we have producers that are out in the crowd that are happy to give you a note card. I have received quite a few questions that are things that I think both Anne and Ross can talk to, but I think that the entire panel can have an opportunity to weigh in on. The questions are about how we de-sprawlify, and then also how we deal with the problems of increased density. There's sort of a sweet spot question that I think is embedded in this that maybe we can discuss. Great.
Ross, you
want to
go ahead and start?
Sure. There's a movement called retrofitting suburbia. And if you look it up, there's quite a bit of background on it. Suburbia, think about a clear cut in a forest. At some point, the forest will restore itself. But it starts, with certain plants that begin to establish the ground and provide a little bit of shade. It's the, in our world, it's the thistles, the alder, things like that. It grows up, and then there are other things that grow up. So we can rejuvenate suburbia. But to do that, there's a really thoughtful planning. It's taking a look at, first of all, what are the transportation networks that could be reinforced? And what are the nodes? And if we can begin to establish efficient transportation systems and focus the improvements on the places where that can happen. And so you've got the emergence of more village-like developments in places that already have those nodes of availability that are there. And then begin to bring in other mix of services in walkable locations. So we can begin to establish fields among this broad expanse of suburbia. And I think it's going to be challenging because there are going to be a lot of the areas of suburbia that are going to continue to be challenged into the longer future. And the areas that are the village centers are going to begin to thrive, because I think the small-scale nature of the villages makes for civil conversation, and that's a whole other conversation and maybe a whole other panel. But I think that the idea of retrofitting is going to happen in these nodes with a whole variety of elements to reinforce the livability. Mm.
I'll just add to that, because I was actually going to say the same thing. There's an organization called the Congress for the New Urbanism. I highly recommend you go to that website. We have a number of initiatives, and one of the primary ones we've been working on for about 10 years is retrofitting suburbia. And in fact, one of our board members, Ellen Dunham Jones, wrote the book on that. And another woman, if you're very interested in design and want to see actual project possibilities, Galina Tashieva with DPZ wrote another book that's very, very graphic. It's got lots of wonderful things. Also, you were talking about the nodes. Chris Leinberger always, with the Brookings Foundation, always recommends that a city go in and through a public process identify those nodes that you know are the centers of your community. And in most cases, they're going to be those historic, like the Hill. Mm-hmm. That's just one that comes to mind for me immediately. But there are others. The university probably, is an institution on the edge, maybe, of, the Hill. But to identify those nodes and develop a form-based code that determines the capacity that you want.
Ann, don't get out in front of us. What's a form-based code?
Oh, okay. All right. Sorry. Zoning codes are typically codes that deal with use, primarily use. Single-family zoning, multifamily. I mean, what is a single family? Seriously, think about that. There's a company called MuniCode in Florida, in Sarasota, that handles the zoning codes for 24,000 cities around the country. And I can tell you that most of your zoning code is cut and paste. Where did they? That's not unique to Boulder. Boulder's a fabulous place. Look at your historic areas. Do your own analysis of what the road widths were originally before you messed them up. The sidewalks, the buildings, you know, the proportion. It was built well to weather, you know, your environment here. Your buildings are built that way. Look at all of that and put it inside what's called a form-based code. I actually worked on one called the SMART code, which is just a template. But you have to, what we call, locally calibrate it. It has all these blanks in it so that you have to put those dimensions in. You have to put the height of the buildings. Well, we don't just do height. We say stories because stories is much more important. But that's what a form-based code is. And you decide what you want in there. It includes mixed use, a requirement for mixed use in nodes, and another technical thing, but the transect. That's also in CNU. You will learn about that, which talks about the rural to urban. That if you're in the rural area, it should be rural. There should not be townhouses or hot tall buildings in your rural areas. In your downtowns, there should not be barns. Your downtowns and your centers, but you'll see that. All over America, in sprawl, you'll see townhouses in the middle of nowhere. But so your centers should be centers. You should have a general area, like what's around the hill, I think of the historic areas. And then you have the edges. And the edges lead into the agricultural areas. But anyway... but you identify those nodes. This is what Chris Leinberger says, and he's done lots of financial work on this, and is a developer and works for the Urban Land Institute as well. But you identify those nodes, and then you connect them. You build them up the way you want to. Some will be more intense, more density, more uses than others. Like your downtown should be your primary node, and then you pick neighborhood nodes that are, you know, of lower density, and you code all of those and build them out and connect them, and then everything else will fill in. But that's the least expensive way to do it. If you try to, you know, go out in the exurbs and start there, you're going to waste a lot of money, and honestly, it's just not going to be efficient.
Great.
That was too much. I'm sorry.
No, that was great. So a question that I've got addresses high-tech and low-tech solutions for building community resilience. The question that I got was about how we address cybersecurity concerns if we increase the level of tech in smart cities as a way of combating resilience. Maybe you can speak to how we address cybersecurity concerns. And then, Leslie, if you, in you know the process of coming up with design incentives and offering design awards, how you address similar concerns between the pros and cons that different products offer.
Sure.
Great.
Did you want to go first?
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. Cybersecurity is obviously a major point of concern for any technology, and especially those that we might be entrusting city functions and city services into. And actually, yesterday on a panel, someone cited a quote that said there are two kinds of companies: those have been hacked, and those that don't know it yet. It's what we do need is to assume that we will be hacked and to build in resilience into our technology infrastructure. Fortunately, you may or may not know that the way the internet was designed, it's a dispersed set of technologies because it was built, it was designed during World War II, and it was assumed that if one kind of network, piece of the network had been knocked out, communications could circumvent the outage. So fortunately, we have this resilience sort of built in, and what we need to do is to be watchful of our networks, obviously build in defenses as much as we can, and then build backup solutions on top of every existing top-line solution.
Should I jump in right away?
Yeah,
okay.
That sounds great.
I actually might go back to Anne's point. I think it was really interesting about talking about urban density. And I think what is really important is how do we entice people to move out of cities? And I think what, you know, we could take the Tesla Roadster approach. So I can imagine if you guys remember when the Tesla Roadster came out, that it was this electric car that all of a sudden changed the entire perception of electric cars. It was no longer about, you know, these golf carts. It made sustainability very desirable, very sexy, and, you know, it was something people wanted. And I think that's an approach that we should really take about wanting people to move out of the cities. So I think we've seen some really interesting developments, particularly in the Netherlands, where they're building up these amazing eco-cities that are very desirable. You know, they make young people want to move out there. And I actually think that's one great way that we can really encourage people to, move out of the city and enjoy life and, really take sustainability seriously and something that people actually want to participate in.
Great. Yeah. So I have a climate-related question that's also relative to here in Boulder. A question came in that said that urban resilience is often thought of as a way of combating things like rising sea levels, the risk of tsunamis. In inland communities and places like Boulder, what are the resilience concerns and what recommendations would each of you make to the city of Boulder in creating more resilient urban spaces? Anyone that wants to jump in?
So we saw in the Midwest a couple of weeks ago, which is also an inland area, we saw extreme flooding. And that is climate related, even though it was considered a kind of natural disaster. It was because there had been a kind of extreme winter of snow and then a rapid rise of temperatures that caused the rapid melting of snow. That is why there was flooding, so it is climate related, and so that is an area of concern, and that could potentially be a concern here as well. Flooding has happened in Boulder. Some solutions that have worked elsewhere, and I'm sure Boulder is considering them, are things like permeable pavement, which is that when we pave our streets, not just using classic asphalt, but instead using asphalt that water can seep through and then be kind of moved away from the roadway to be released into a sewer or some water body. And other concerns that are not directly related to rising seas are extreme temperatures, which actually relate to the energy usage required for heating and cooling of our homes. There is a lot of energy usage that will be dedicated to these functions as temperatures reach extreme highs and lows. And so ensuring that the electric grid is ready for that kind of functionality and that fluctuation, that's another mitigation measure. And of course, reducing our reliance on cars, as has been discussed, which not only improves the air quality, but reduces wear and tear on our roadways, which is another concern for an inland area like this one.
I'd just like to add a little bit. I saw and heard stories of the flood that happened here not long ago, a few years ago, in not only Boulder, but the whole Front Range. I was just amazed at the floods, where you wouldn't think there'd be flooding. Things flooding where you just go, flood. There's nobody even thought of floods, and here they are. And I think that as we are humans, we come in and we are not aware of longer spans of time. And when we've got climate change coming, it's moving the 1,000-year flood to the 10-year flood. Mm-hmm. And so we've built on places that are so beautiful. And we don't realize that we're building in an area that we're concentrating the floods because we're trying to, either we're not aware of them, or we're concentrating by building levees, which then just only increases the flooding damage. And the idea of building a forest next to the ocean to protect the tsunami, protecting in the Gulf Coast, the importance of the, what do you call the whole low...
Oh, the barriers.
The barriers, that is vital. And so I think as we begin to plan and replan and think ahead in our cities, in your city, taking a look at, well, where does water flow? Where it has flown, you know, gone before. But it's going to perhaps be more concentrated because we've got these thousand-year blasts that come in now more often. So we need to begin to design for that.
Yeah, and I've worked a lot. I spent most of my career working at the neighborhood block level. But recently, I've gotten very, very interested in regional planning. I think it is critical, and I cannot believe that America has no national planning office, so that the different regions can get together and plan, because we should be basing all of our planning on watersheds. Watersheds and aquifers to protect our water. You have droughts here. My skin just dries up here. So saving that water and figuring out ways to purify it so you can use it when you need the water. There's also, and I just have to bring this up, there are lots of disturbances. It's not just weather, but we have financial crises. We have political upheavals. There are so many other disturbances we don't think about that I think we need to plan for.
Absolutely. Leslie, this is jumping back to a comment that you made.
Sure.
You made a comment about incentivizing sprawl, and I think it was in line with this idea that more green space provides for more environmental flexibility. Those green belts that are forested allow for some opportunity for some permeable surfaces to uptake some of the water if there's flooding risk. A question came in about how we balance between increasing sprawl and also looking at increasing green space. And I don't know if you... Yeah, how do we decrease sprawl and increase green space? And so maybe the tension between those two things.
I guess it's back to my point about, incentivizing, obviously, moving out of the city. But then, of course, you really need to build up the infrastructure, particularly with transportation. I mean, in the States, you guys are also dependent on your cars. And, of course, that's one major thing difference between living in Copenhagen, where everyone can bike everywhere, and they have the infrastructure where it's very easy to get around. I think it's tricky. It's really hard for me to speak about the States because I'm not really savvy about how it is here. But, I'm not really sure what...
Sure.
Yeah.
Does anyone else want to
do that? It might be a little
bit
tricky.
I can jump in. Actually, this is directly from the States, but in both India and China, cities are largely over capacity, and so the governments of both countries are building out these kind of secondary cities and incentivizing the populations of these 25 million person cities to move out to these new cities that are being built from the ground up. And they have a lot of the sustainability infrastructure being built in because they're brand new cities. So there is an opportunity to live in an urban environment, but not necessarily the densest urban environment. And I think that we can learn a lot from the experiences of these countries.
Can I jump in? We missed a part of a question a little while ago. I don't know exactly what it was, but the key word for me was density. I think density has been given a really bad name, because the kind of design of development that's happening has been really dumb density. It's been density without the fabric of connectivity, without the response to our need for personal space and privacy. And so I think that density is critical. If we build out at the low, and some other parts of the world would consider ultra-low density, and we establish these, greenfield cities that have all these, perfect things, we are still building sprawl where we're tied in a major way to the car and the automobile. The automobile has been given a future since it came around nearly 100 years ago that was supposedly endless. Well, there's going to be an arc to the end of this kind of development at some point. Think out 30 years, 40, 50 years. Can we still build to the automobile in 30 years, in 40, 50, 100 years? Oh, my God. Okay, so we've got to do something different. And I think we need to begin to rethink density and give density. I mean, okay, you go to Europe. God, that's awful. I mean, the walkable, it's so damn tight. It's so, just these towns and villages that you go through are just really terrible. There are people everywhere and there are buildings that are so close, you hate them. No. They are so far more dense than America, and they are loved. So we need to bring lovability into our cities. Lovability is a technical term, right?
Yeah.
Yes, it is now.
And beauty is too.
And community is. And so there's a way to bring what we love most, what we value most, the connectivity, the people places, and bring the cities back into human scale and conversational scale.
Right, and here are the five C's. Five C's of great communities. They're complete, meaning they're mixed use. They're compact. I prefer that over density. They're connected. They're complex, and they're convivial. And they, on all, there are lots of words that describe each of those.
Perfect. So we have a student question that I think fits in with this conversation well. What role does public-private partnership play in shaping our policies toward resilient change? We have a variety of questions that address how we engage people in the process of building more urban, resilient spaces. So if anyone has ideas about community mobilization and public-private partnership. Yeah. And maybe your work
follows. Well, you know, they say that there are people that firmly believe that it's not government that's going to lead the way. It's going to be private industry and companies and communities that that push their local companies to do it. It was fun. It was interesting after Katrina in New Orleans because we have no major industry there. We don't have any. We have no national folks there. All the oil and gas industry had moved over to Houston. So everything that we did, we had to do on our own or beg from other places. But I think that there's no way that we can do it without public-private partnership. And I do think that the private realm needs to lead that conversation.
I've been involved in the private development world, and I don't know a great deal about public-private partnership, so I can't answer that completely. But what I can say is that jurisdictions can create an environment that would give a base that you could have the blossoming of private initiated projects happening. So I love small houses designed right-sized to our lives. There's a disincentive in most codes that say you've got the same fee structure, fees applied to a 5,000 square foot house as they do to a 500 square foot house. This is wrong. We need to take a look at incentivizing right-sized homes. We need to incentivize ways in which it's the people, not the streets. Streets are more than just transportation. Streets are people places. And yet you've got engineers who are often creating the policy and the code because that's safe. Safety. Well, from a person who takes people into account, I go, you know, a slower street is a safer street. A street that has shade trees and places for people is a loved street and places where people are going to be. That's going to be safer. So that's policy affecting development and creating incentives for, I think, real projects to happen in the private sector.
Right. I should have added to, though, public and private, but actually a nonprofit should lead the actual implementation. That third lab is very important.
Public-private partnerships play a key role in how cities get things done. In major cities like New York, Chicago, and L.A., we've seen a lot of businesses that surround parks, for example, partner with the city to clean up the park, maintain it, and make it a welcoming space for the public. It's while all stakeholders obviously should be considered, a huge part of public-private partnerships is incentivizing businesses to have jobs at all levels available in the downtown for any type of worker to be able to work there. And what follows from businesses being located in one area is the cultural interest, museums, restaurants, bars, that bring people to this area and grow these downtowns. And it's and it becomes a cyclical thing where people move to cities because they're interesting and because there are people they want to be around, and then more and more businesses develop. And part of what's happening in the United States is that we're already moving towards a pattern of density generationally. The millennial generation is vastly preferring cities to suburbs, and this is only increasing. And people who are under 25 tend to not buy cars. People who are teenagers tend to not pursue driver's licenses to the same degree that they did 20 years ago, 50 years ago, because it's not as necessary and it's not as interesting to take on the debt of a car on top of college debt, on top of other goals that they have in life. So I think it's happening organically, and it is a generational divide, but it is slowly making its way.
Great. I had a conversation with Joshua David, who was very involved in creating the High Line in New York City. Does everybody know about the High Line?
No. Oh, yeah.
Okay, is Joshua David here?
He is. Oh, I don't know if he's in there.
Well, look him up. He's got a session on design that lives on at 12 o'clock. And he talked with me about the public-private partnership that he had to negotiate for the last 16 or 20 years to create the amazing High Line. It's like the new Central Park of New York City. And he was the instigator of it and was a major private-public liaison to make it happen. So,
yeah,
just a shout out for,
great,
for Josh.
Yeah, and you brought up a point that was that resilience is about more than just finding ways that we can mitigate environmental impacts, but it's also about economic resilience and social resilience. We have a question here that asks, sort of at the intersection between social and ecological, how do we look to indigenous knowledge as a source of informing the way that we develop in a resilient way?
So how do we look to what?
Indigenous knowledge, the knowledge of native peoples.
Local stories.
Yeah. Yeah, anyone that wants to jump in?
Let me jump in on that one, because this, I'm struggling with words for this, because I think it's touching something. So here we are, we're talking about technical solutions, we're talking about development, we're talking about, if I may, dominion over the land. We're talking about how the resources are used for the highest human use. There's a spirit of the land. If you're native, this is not a question. If you're in the ocean, you're not going to wonder what is water. If we are human, if we get back to what it means to be human, we are going to be of the earth. There's a spirit of the earth. There's a spirit that is present. And if we tune in to what that means in our own lives, then we are going to move forward with our actions where that is like water. It is of us. We're going to be fully water. We're going to be fully land. We're going to honor this. And my take on the indigenous offering to the modern life is this unquestionable spirit that pervades all, and that we are not separate, we are one, and that the world is not inert, it is living. And as we move from where we are, this divisive consciousness that have maybe started since Descartes, maybe since the Industrial Revolution, I don't know, but it's this thin little blip in human history where we have been apart from. And we are moving into a world beyond whatever this conjunction of crises is, the vectors that are coming together. if we live long enough, our children live long enough, we're going to live to another era. And they were seeing and feeling the seeds of that. And I believe there's something, and the questions that I have, and I'll be, I'll stop in a minute here. I'd like to carry this conversation on further. We can't let go of our knowledge and our abilities and our intellect and the amazing capability of data and communication and networks that are like never before in the history of the earth. And we are need to remarry ourselves with the sacred and become fully conscious as we move. How do you be fully conscious? Be one with the water and the land as we make our choices and decisions, and see that we're creating a web of life, not a infrastructure for the highest human use.
Okay. Yeah. Would anyone like to follow with other thoughts? That was really great. Thank you, Ross. If not, I have plenty of other questions that we can dive into as well. As Ross said, this is a really important conversation. There are other panels that will look more explicitly at the offering that Indigenous peoples have. And it's something that is part of the initiative process around bringing more Indigenous speakers here to the conference. So if this is something of interest, please engage with the conference, and we'll find a way to make this an even more prominent part of the conversation. A question I have is from the students. What internship opportunities do you have and offer that can allow students and community members to engage in the work that you do around resilience for each one of you?
We're always looking for volunteers. And I have to say that that's how I started. I found somebody. I loved the work that they were doing. They were doing amazing things. I knew I had a lot to learn. And I've all started volunteering on their projects, and they started hiring me. And that's how I did mine. But I think students very much need to get involved. They need to vote. Need to get involved in decisions that impact them much more than their parents or their grandparents and their own children. So... do what you are passionate about. I think that's the most important thing, because you're going to do it well. But in the planning field, there are a lot of opportunities, and it all begins with civic engagement, I think.
I mean, at least at Index, we have an incredibly diverse team. We're only 20, but we speak a lot of different languages and from a lot of different countries. I think diversity is so important to us. And often, we're a design company, but we all come from an insane amount of different backgrounds. And I think it's what's really inspiring is we get so many young people who are, so motivated to change and to be involved. And we're always recruiting. So if there's anyone who would like to join us, then please. I would love it if you would reach out.
Okay. I'm coming from New York University, so I highly recommend going to graduate school if you're considering it. It's a really great way to develop your specialty in one area and to establish a network of peers and mentors in the area that you're interested in. It's a fabulous way to get involved in something you're excited about, and it's something I highly recommend for any undergrads here.
With regard to the students in the design world, I think it's really important to get your hands dirty, to get out there and get into construction in the simplest way, to see what it's like, to feel what it's like to build. To when you're out there in the building, you make decisions differently than if you're in some enclosed office with artificial lights. Maybe you've got a window. It doesn't matter. When you're out there in the field, you're going to experience and engage in the world in a fundamentally different way. And maybe you're not going to end up in construction, but that experience is going to carry then through your life, and you are going to have that as part of your perspective and what your offer is later in your life and in your career.
And also, networking is so important. Students, go to the CNU.org website. We have conference every year, plus we have regional chapters, and you can volunteer and get there free on scholarship or as a volunteer. And I promise you, you will meet some of the, you know, top planners, thinkers on all of these issues, and developers, people actually doing the work, bankers, that you will meet in any other organization.
Yeah. Leslie, we have a question that came in for you.
Sure.
What are some of the most exciting projects that Index is pursuing? What are the things that make you most excited? And then what are your thoughts on a 16-year-old who created a ocean cleaning system and other young entrepreneurs?
I mean, I think we've been running this awards program since 2005, so we've been focused on design for sustainability and in the pursuit of a better world for quite some time. Of course, it's very hip now, but we thankfully have an advantage because we have such a large archive, which is now sort of almost cresting 8,000 solutions. I think, at least for me, the most exciting developments are the real game changers. So, for example, lab-grown meat. It's a very interesting and touchy topic, and a lot of people are apprehensive about it, and I can understand that. But then I think with the challenge we're faced with conventional farming, that we can't continue to go along that way, and it's still in early stages. You know, the first lab-grown meat steak cost, you know, $38,000, and of course that's insane. But then when we think about the first computer, how much that cost, I think those kinds of solutions that have the potential to really, really change the way the world develops and how we, you know, proceed in this world, they're most exciting to me, at least. And referring to the ocean cleanup, I guess a lot of you have seen a gentleman called Boyan Slat. He's developed this, he thought about it when he was 16. He's now about 23 years old. He basically came up with this idea to put in it kind of works like a huge filter into the largest ocean currents. So instead of pursuing this plastic, trying to chase it around, that the currents actually collect the plastic when you put this large sort of funnel thingy. It's safe for wildlife, don't worry. So it was actually implemented in the Northern Pacific Garbage Patch recently. I don't know if anyone has seen it. So they put it in, it broke, and they had to bring it back in for repairs. But I think it's been in the media a lot. People are very skeptical about it. But at the same time, and I think as soon as it broke down, everyone was saying, you know, I told you so, it wasn't going to work. But I think that attitude is never helpful. How often do you implement a design and that it works the first time? I think we need more people like Boyan Slat. I mean, being only 16 and coming up, you know, raising millions and millions of dollars, having so many people on board to solve, you know, such an insanely difficult challenge. I mean, I'm very optimistic about the future. I think we're just seeing so many young people come up with these far-fetched solutions. And, you know, people want to get involved, and I think it's really, really inspiring.
Great. Yeah, and you looked excited maybe to contribute or had anything else you were excited about? If not, I have another question. Great. This is also for Leslie, maybe a plug. Layla Jarlou is joining us. She was our keynote address speaker, and she offered insights into systems thinking. There's a movie that's showing that was created out of Index, mm-hmm. Enough White Teacups. This question is about maybe if you could offer some explanation around the White Teacups model and where people can see the movie.
I guess the origin of Enough White Teacups came from our CEO when she started the organization. Again, our goal was basically to challenge the perception of design. You know, when a lot of people think of design, they think of beautiful lamps, designer chairs, fashion graphics. And that was very much our mission at the beginning. You know, design has such a capacity to solve so many problems, and that we should be encouraging people who have these creative skills to be applying them to something very useful, these real problems. So that the premise of Enough White Teacups is sort of exploring basically the solutions we've seen for the past 13 years. I think it's going to be screened on PBS soon. Actually, I should know this. It was made by a wonderful documentary maker called Michelle Carpenter. She's a Boulder local. Some of you might know her. And I encourage you, I think I will find out and we can have a chat later about when exactly it's screening, but it's a wonderful film and it really showcases, you know, the progression of design, and that people are finally seeing that, yeah, exactly, it's more than teacups and, you know, embellishment, and that it's such a powerful tool that we need.
It will be shown on PBS October 24th. For
Thank you very
curious.
Much.
I got a note from the audience. Thank you. This is crowdsourcing information. Yeah. Really effective.
Perfect. Yeah.
Cool. So we just reached 10 o'clock. I think that means we can start to close up the conversation. I want to offer an opportunity for any of you to share some closing thoughts, if you have any, about the ways that we can build resiliently.
Let Ross start.
Yeah, Ross, feel free to start. Thank you so much.
Well, I'm going to come back to, for me, the basics that move me forward in my work is looking at the scale of sociability. And in small groups, we can't help but be sociable. And so in development, how we can move in creating small clusters, whether it be individual houses or townhouses or vertically in cities. You get out of the elevator and you come into more of a living room commons, and you might have 8 apartments around. And I call that these are your barefoot neighbors, or your pajama neighbors, where you show up for a movie night or bring your potluck dinner, into there. And so the idea of a pocket neighborhood is not just, if you've seen any of my work, I work in more rural towns and suburbs. And so they are individual houses. They're often cottage-like, etc. It doesn't have to be about that style. It's anything. And the idea is bring small-scale people together in small clusters. In larger developments, you'd end up continuing that small scale. And so you'd get a mosaic of a whole variety of development types, housing types linked together, but the common molecule is maybe 6 to 12. I think that's important. In homeless housing, if you've got, it's not just an aggregate of tents or tiny houses just scattered like snowflakes and spaghetti, or snowflakes and image disappeared, but they're in clusters. After Katrina, I have a friend who is a FEMA inspector, and they had cleared acres and acres and acres of land, and they arranged all these trailers up in rows. And they were so proud that they could deliver 10,000 units of housing. And so you're traumatized, and you're in row Q, building 15. Imagine at the end of the day, instead of that, you've got like wagons around the campfire. You've got a few FEMA trailers around a picnic table, a sun shelter, a play area for kids. How does healing happen after trauma? Through stories and storytelling. It's not about how much it's going to cost. It's about creating that place to be present with one another. And so that notion carries on in design. One last thing, I don't want to take too much time, I think we're good, is that, okay, you're not a developer, that's fine. If you've got a backyard fence, consider a neighbor or two where you can take it out. If you've got a picnic table, move it to your front yard. That little strip beyond your front yard that's supposedly public open space, well, plant tomatoes or corn. You plant a garden, you grow food, you grow community.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thanks.
Okay, I'll just jump in there. I'll keep mine short and sweet. I think the most important thing is education. I mean, we need to reform that. I think it's really important that we don't sugarcoat things for our kids. I think if we really see the solutions they can come up with when we tell it like it is, and we say, these are our problems, you need to come up with solutions. I mean, we've run programs for kids as young as 6, and talking about them, you know, about refugees, about climate change. And I mean, you'd be impressed about the things that they can come up with, I guess, you know, because sometimes they're so uninhibited in their thoughts. So I think that's the most important thing. If we've got these challenges, then we should start teaching our kids now, so then they can be prepared for as the world develops.
Great.
Um, I will also keep mine short and sweet, but three ideas. Demand better public transportation from your local elected officials, because that is the way you will need to get around in the future. Try driving your car less, even if you take one less trip a week and instead take the bus or a bike or a scooter or walk. That's a better way to get around. Just try it once a week. And then finally, for the younger people in the room, if you don't already know how, learn to code, because that is how we're going to solve many of the big issues coming down in the future.
And finally, I'm just going to say resiliency begins with human happiness. So, and we have to work together to get there. It takes a village. It really does take a village. And we found that post-Katrina, it was just something that I hope no one ever has to go through. But the only way that people got things done was by working together and taking care of the community and the social places and institutions first, and then worrying about their homes. So...
perfect. Well, thank you everyone for coming today. We had a wealth of questions. I have a whole stack up here. If your question didn't get addressed, our speakers can stay for about 5 minutes. Please be respectful of their time. They do have other panels to get to, but they can chat briefly if you didn't get your questions answered. Thank you again for coming today. Give a final round of applause.
Thank you.